From WGCU News, this is Gulf Coast Live. Amid growing demand for services, mental health treatment facilities in Southwest Florida are expanding their capacity to address the needs of pediatric patients in crisis. Many of these patient admissions are through Florida's Baker Act statute, which allows for the involuntary commitment of a patient for up to 72 hours if they're deemed to be a danger to themselves or others. A closer look at Florida's Baker Act and the challenges of meeting local demand for pediatric mental health services. Plus, NASA is growing vegetables at the International Space Station through a program with roots right here in Southwest Florida. We'll explore the Sarasota-based company and Sarasota hydroponic farming operation that are helping to make space farming possible and how sustainable food production is key to advancing future manned space travel. First, this news. This is Gulf Coast Live from WGCU News. I'm John Davis. Thanks for joining us. NASA has successfully completed experiments that grow edible crops in space. Along the subject of science fiction, it's now science fact on the International Space Station. NASA's Veggie Project successfully grew a small crop of red romaine lettuce last summer using technology and methods pioneered right here in Southwest Florida. Coming up, we'll talk with the program director at NASA's Kennedy Space Center, who is overseeing the project, as well as the Sarasota entrepreneur and farmer whose work is bearing fruit more than 200 miles above the Earth's surface on the space station. But first, accessing mental health care services for children can be a challenge in Florida. Patients must combat the stigma of mental illness while also navigating a system beset with transportation issues, language barriers, waiting lists, and more. The State Department of Children and Families estimates the current public substance abuse and mental health system meets just 10% of the children in need across Florida. According to the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors, Incorporated, Florida stands in 49th place in a ranking of states based on per capita spending on access to mental health care services. A State Department of Children and Families report finds that more than 330,000 children in Florida struggle with serious emotional disturbances. Now, major providers in Lee, Charlotte, and Collier counties are expanding their pediatric facilities to meet that growing need. Many of those patients are involuntarily committed for a period of up to 72 hours under Florida's Baker Act statute. Some see it as a vital tool in getting kids the help they need, while others are more critical of the program and its increasing use in Florida. Joining me live in studio is Tina Sumo, the Assistant Vice President of Acute Care Services for Salus Care in Fort Myers. She's responsible for the 42-bed Crisis Stabilization Unit and the 29-bed Detoxification Unit of Salus Care. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
Also joining us today is Jennifer Ernst, Chief Operating Officer of Charlotte Behavioral Healthcare in Punta Gorda. Next month, they're breaking ground on a new 10-bed crisis stabilization unit. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
And also on today's show is Melissa Caldwell. She's a Naples mother whose son Caleb suffers from mental illness. She'll share her experience finding the right help for her son, from counseling to medication to calling police to initiate a Baker Act referral. We'll also hear portions of a previously recorded interview with Scott Burgess, the CEO of the David Lawrence Center, which receives Baker Act referrals in Collier County and offers a variety of other mental health services. Listeners can join our conversation on mental health for kids in Southwest Florida, the needs you see, and the questions you have. Our phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. You can share your thoughts online, head to our Facebook page at WGCU Public Media, or find us on Twitter. We're at WGCU. Tweet your thoughts using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And Melissa, let's start with you. Your son, Caleb, exhibited troubling behavior from an early age. Can you tell us about your path to diagnosis for Caleb and how that diagnosis changed as he grew older and started, you know, going through puberty?
Yes. Caleb, when I brought him home from the hospital, screamed for hours. And I could never figure out what was the matter with him. I thought something was harming him, that something could be wrong with him. And he never would settle down. When he was just about sitting up, he was like 4 or 5 months old, he would bang his head on the wall and get so angry and scream. And so this anger and emotional disturbance started from birth, and it continued on. We struggled in school as we knew he had ADHD. We tried to do it without medication the best that we could, giving him tilt tables. I worked with the teachers endlessly, and he kept having some emotional problems through school where he would, if he was playing with children, his way of playing with them was running around and screaming and hitting them on the head as he would go by. And if he wanted their hula hoops, he would headbutt them and take it from the children. One day we were called to the school where he had kneed a little girl in her private area. And that was, he wasn't angry at her. It was just his way of communicating with her, which was not okay. The school called me, and they had me come into the office because they wanted to talk to me because Caleb wasn't upset that he had hurt somebody, that somebody had been injured, and that they were upset with him. So she let me know this isn't really how emotionally someone should respond. So I knew that we were having some issues. You try as a parent to just go and do what you can do for them, giving them the best support that they could. And eventually, not far from that time, he started telling us that he wanted to die and that he wanted to kill himself. This would happen from
How old is that? Just to get it, sorry to interrupt.
Yeah, that's okay. But when he was in third grade, so he was around 8 or 9, it was very scary. We love our children, and I can't ever imagine a child feeling this way. This stemmed from, hey, can you go put your shoes in your room? It wasn't that anyone was – he wasn't in trouble. Mm-hmm. So it was just a minor question that you would ask a normal child that they would go and put – you know, they might give you a little slack or try to go play their video game or do something like that. So we knew that we had a huge issue, and I was very scared. So we took him to our pediatrician. At the time, we lived in Tampa, and so we were referred to a psychiatrist, and that's where we got his initial diagnosis of oppositional defiance disorder, ADHD, bipolar. And that was really scary because he kind of sat me down and just said, this is going to be a long, hard road for you. Mm-hmm. And left untreated, he can become sociopath. And hearing that is scary. Very scary because we were also suffering with a little bit of sexual deviance problems. We are trying to address those. So he did get on medication then, and his symptoms were so under control. It was great. It was like the medicine was a miracle drug. And so we felt great. We did do some counseling a few times a week. Then we moved here to Collier County. And when he started going through puberty, around 12 to 13, everything just exploded. And his behaviors became too much to handle. And that's when we started our first Baker Acts and that kind of thing. He was destroying our property. He was self-harming, which was another thing that started that was very scary to us because I had never known anybody personally who had gone through that. And so we had to really figure out why he was doing that.
So this wasn't just an issue of, you know, adjusting the dose of a medication as he grew older. There was something else.
Right, because we were kind of we were adjusting some of his medications. And I knew at that time that we kind of were entering where he needed more medications. And that was a fight to get more medications. And I think medication is a huge benefit. I know that there are some that decide not to use medication. We tried to not use medication for as long as we could. And I do know wholeheartedly, without the medications that Caleb's on, and he's on a lot of medications, without those medications, my son wouldn't be alive today because he would have taken his life. And I just feel like, why let him sit and suffer and feel this way every day of his life when we can give him medications and he can be happy and healthy and live a fulfilled life? So that's my take on medication. I know it's not the same for everybody, and everybody feels very differently. So I guess with the puberty, it did spawn a lot of extra things. And a lot of things that we were seeing when he was younger, we do, as parents, we just think that they're just being normal kids, especially boys. Boys are off the
walls. Rowdy.
Yes.
Yeah.
So you know, I just didn't look at him and think, oh, my goodness, this is so bad, you know. And then It is hard, too, because sometimes when you go into schools, you are seeing other children. As we did have other children, too, you're comparing them. So you are seeing this isn't really so normal what we're seeing. Right. So,
well, and I understand also as Caleb got older and became, you know, the problems were exacerbated. NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness, played a big part in getting you or Caleb, rather, the help he needed. How so? How did they help?
Well, I hadn't even heard of David Lawrence, and we had been living in the community for a few years. And even with our pediatrician, we hadn't been introduced to David Lawrence. I had actually picked up a magazine that they put out in Collier County, Family Magazine, and they had something going on, and it was for, I think, bipolar. It was a talk or what have you. And I had kind of saved it. And we had an issue where Caleb was becoming very suicidal. It was a very scary night for us. And so I called them the next day to see what they could do. And they referred us over to David Lawrence, and they actually – the lady who's head of the HUGS program for NAMI of Collier County came to the David Lawrence Center with us and helped me navigate that process, which was very beneficial because it's scary. It's very scary. And that's when we were first talking about Baker X, which I had never even heard of or been a part of. That's how NAMI had gotten us in touch with David Lawrence. And from there, David Lawrence has taken over all of Caleb's counseling, his outpatient counseling. We also have a phenomenal TBOS counselor that comes in home twice a week for Caleb and works with us in our own environment, which is huge for Caleb. Because going to a facility once a week, you know, kids, they forget. My son has been diagnosed with autism. They forget these little things. So it's hard to kind of go back the entire week and get a hold of those situations and those scenarios. And throughout the week, you're having these huge outbursts that where we're having to call the police, and he's having to be Baker acted. So when the TBOS counselors comes in, we can work on his coping skills throughout the week. And that's what's made his actual Baker acts go down significantly, is having that extra support through the David Lawrence Center.
Well, take us back to that time when you first made the decision to call the police. I get the impression that at that point, because of the contacts that you had made through David Lawrence Center, through NAMI, you were aware that the Baker Act referral was a plausible inevitability there.
Yes. When we started therapy through David Lawrence Center, they did explain to us what that process looked like and when we needed to use that. Because at home, you just don't think to call the police on your children. They are little. And, of course, we were worried when he would try to kill himself or say that he wanted to kill himself. But as parents, that's what we do. We take care of our children. So they explained to us that we did need to call the police. And then they would come into the house. And then they would be able to tell us if he needed to be Baker acted or not, which, of course, by the time we've gotten to the point where we're calling the police, it was a definite Baker act issue. That's how we came along with it. And it is a scary process. It is scary. And they were very upfront with us and very honest. Children's Services is alerted. And I think that was explained to me, too, because that's very scary to think that Children's Services are going to come into your home. And because we're being good parents, we're not doing anything wrong to our child. But they are there to help you. And they're there to make sure that the whole family is safe. So being through that process, it wasn't horrible. And I didn't suffer any bad consequences. We only got help. That's what we got.
All right. Well, let's turn to our the mental health professionals in the room with us today. Tina Sumo with Salus Care and Jennifer Ernst with Charlotte Behavioral Health. I want to ask you about accessing pediatric mental health care in Southwest Florida. You know, everything from getting a first diagnosis to setting up ongoing counseling and medication. Is Melissa's story typical? Is this something you hear about a lot?
In a lot of cases, yes, you know, and people don't know where to go. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that I know at Charlotte Behavioral that we're working on is expanding our information into the community and letting more people know about our services. You shouldn't be in our community for multiple years without knowing that we exist. And also expanding that information to the pediatricians as well, because where should the psychiatry be performed, and is it at the pediatrician level?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, a good point there. I mean, are there strategies that mental health officials or, you know, just other general healthcare professionals can employ to try and diagnose a child, you know, before their behavior becomes overwhelming for parents?
I think it's getting them in as quick as possible. Mm-hmm. As we know, the earlier your child is treated and that the diagnosis is made, the sooner we can start the medication if that's what's needed, or the therapy, and we can get working on those areas. Like you mentioned, as time goes on, it gets worse. And so if we can get them in, we have children as young as 4 years old that are being Baker-acted into our system. And it's really sad and unfortunate, but we're able to get them in and get them help.
All right. And Jennifer, you know, while we're speaking with you here, just tell us a bit about the expansions that are planned for Charlotte Behavioral Healthcare. Looking to break ground next month, I understand.
We are. We are going to they're actually starting to remove some of the trees and stuff that are on the property right now. But over the course of the past couple of years, we have seen a huge expansion need in our community for crisis services. And so back in 2011, and I'll just give you some pediatric numbers,
sure.
We served 223 children in our crisis stabilization unit. This year, well, let's talk about 2015, since that one's over, we saw 470 children. This year alone in 2016, we're already at 305. So we're already expecting to break the 470 that we saw last year. The need exists. And so with that need, we decided to expand our entire crisis stabilization unit by 10 beds. We're currently a 20-bed mixed unit. And so expanding by an additional 10, we're really hoping to meet more of the need in our community. And I know that we talked before the air and about how you at one point had to move your son from David Lawrence Center up to Charlotte Behavioral, and that the inconvenience that placed on you as the family. And I think that that's all of our goal in the room today, is to really decrease having to move the kids out of county, to decrease the frustrations and the burden that that puts on the parents who really want to be actively involved.
And it is a point of how many beds are available. That's mm-hmm. where we are with that, because that's why we had to go all the way up to Charlotte Behavioral, because the beds were full everywhere. And that was the closest place. And my son actually sat in the emergency room for almost an entire day in a room and a paper outfit.
Yeah.
Which is crazy, and yeah. Until we could get placed, and that's where we went up to, was Charlotte Behavioral Health, because they were the only people who had an open bed.
And that happens more than you know. Mm-hmm. I know Charlotte and David Lawrence, the directors, and myself, we talk together frequently. When one of us is full, we'll call the other one and ask, do you have beds available? And then we're able to transfer between sister agencies to get, the kids where they need to go as fast as possible, so they're not having to stay, in a room and wait for a bed.
And Tina, just, comparing Jennifer's numbers in the Punta Gorda area, seeing that kind of increase and how already this year they already see themselves outpacing those numbers from last year. Similar story at SalusCare?
Yeah, similar story, definitely. We kind of did some stats over the last 7 months and noticed about a 44% increase in Bakerx. And we've had 150 admits since school started.
Well, are those primarily Bakerx initiated by school resource officers?
100 of them are Bakerx. I don't have the breakdowns of where specifically they came from.
Is that part of what prompted SalusCare to increase that inpatient bed capacity to up to 16 now for the crisis unit?
Absolutely. The community need, our increase in numbers. Definitely what we were also experiencing is we would have maybe 13 on the unit, which is our 10% over before we expanded. And what we would see is before parents could pick up their children at discharge, we were getting more into our emergency services, which there wouldn't be a bed for them. So we were having this overflow, which was a giant snag in our system. So we wanted to make sure that we had enough beds for the need, and also for our sister agencies if they needed beds available as well.
All right. If you're just joining us today on Gulf Coast Live, we're talking about mental health care for kids in Southwest Florida, challenges in getting care, and the use of the Baker Act to bringing more children into contact with mental health service providers. Our phone lines are open at 1-877-428-8255. That's 877-GCU-TALK. Send your thoughts online. You can find us on Facebook at WGCU Public Media or on Twitter. We're at WGCU. Tweet using the hashtag Gulf Coast Live. And breaking down stigmas associated with mental health is often a challenge. You know, it's necessary to overcome for people to get the help they need. But also, you know, Melissa, you say there are other stigmas families need to overcome. Like your son Caleb's behavior has at times, you know, as we've already discussed, to have to call the police. That, of course, was a big challenge, overcoming the fear of calling the police on your own child.
Yeah.
But having spoken with folks, you sort of understood what the Baker Act process was going to be, and that I'm assuming that sort of helped alleviate that for you.
Yeah, and I think it's for me and my family personally, we always look at it as a positive because it's only going to help Caleb. It's only going to get him the help that he needs and for him to be safe. I know there's a lot of parents out there that are sitting in my exact same shoes, and you don't know what it's like to go to sleep and wonder what your child's going to do, if they're going to survive the night. And so being able to put them into the unit and knowing that they're safe and nothing's going to, they can't harm themselves, is a huge relief for me as a parent to get him that help that he needs. So we've always looked at it as a positive thing. And I think educating people, and I educate people that I come in contact with daily, people in our neighborhood, and everybody in our neighborhood, you know, I am very vocal and I do let them know what we're facing so that if they see my child in the middle of the night going toward the front of our neighborhood, I will get a text from somebody in our neighborhood to say, hey, we see Caleb, he's at the front. Yeah. And they know something's wrong with him. So I think really speaking out as a parent and trying to get over that stigma can really be beneficial to people because it does take a village to raise a child, and so much more for a child who has issues. So,
Right. But
there is a huge stigma.
Well, and you know, looking at some of the gaps in mental health care for kids, we spoke to Scott Burgess, CEO of the David Lawrence Center, and he says one service that's missing in Southwest Florida is what's known as PHP, partial hospital programs, for kids who are struggling but don't meet the criteria for under the Baker Act for, you know, being a danger to themselves or others. And let's listen to what he had to say about those PHP programs.
In most places in the country, there's a partial hospitalization program where children can come during the day, 5 days a week, and receive really the intensive supports of being in an inpatient setting, but they're sleeping in their own bed at night. So there's some of that kind of normalcy of their life, but they're receiving very intensive support that they really need during a critical period of time in their challenge.
You know, with the explanation of crisis care, you know, underway at Salus Care and Charlotte Behavioral Health, would it be possible to meet this need for a partial hospitalization program? I would imagine, you know, probably more so for kids than anybody else, a big part of the trauma of an involuntary commitment under a Baker Act would be just being separated from your family.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. A separation from family members is horrible, especially when you get some of the younger kids that are Baker Acted. It's very traumatic. I think probably one of the difficult things about having a partial hospitalization is funding. There really is no funding for such a place at this time. Some of the other gaps that we're seeing is transportation problems. A lot of families don't have transportation or very limited transportation. And fortunately, we're able to purchase bus passes for people to try to get back to their appointments, things such as that. Residential treatments. not just partial hospitalization, but kids that have maybe been in the crisis unit multiple amounts of time and may need longer-term treatment. There's limited amounts of residential treatment even in Florida.
Even residential care for parents who – I haven't been on a date with my husband for, I think, 10 years, I think it's been. So residential services – and I know they do exist in Ohio, up north, places like that. But, yeah, transportation, I can't imagine every day going back and forth to somewhere for somebody who is struggling financially, doesn't have a car, parents are working. I mean, it's hard enough for me to get in – fill out the forms that we have to fill out the next day, sometimes day of, but most we all know that the baker ups normally happen at night. So it's normally the next day. And then whenever they go to be removed, you know, we have to have a session. And it's a lot. It's hard on the families.
I think one area that Charlotte Behavioral is looking into that, and I know that there's other agencies that offer it down here as well, but are the CAT team, the community action teams, and the wraparound services that those are able to provide in the community, in the home, and really trying to remove any barriers versus the extensive funding that would be needed for an intensive partial hospitalization. I think that that's one area that I know we're focusing on, is really trying to put that community action team into play. But then also having other areas, that's one thing I will say, is that it seems like we do have a lot of great programs out there for children. It's just about making sure that the community is aware of them. And thankfully, the schools as partners are able to really help, because we do see a lull during the summer of where people aren't coming in and getting the services they need. But now that the school's back in session, getting those kids back and getting them back on track again.
How would you feel that your CAT team and T-Boss, because my son's actually part of T-Boss. So how do you feel staff-wise? Do you feel like you have enough staff to cover that? Because I know David Lawrence, it's hard to get into that program. And you know, they're having to end cases very soon because there's a huge need for it. So how do you feel like it's the same kind of issue?
I think it's going to be, yes. I think there's going to be most places, because the state, it will, once you get a CAT team, it's like many teams, there's a certain amount of slots on that team. And so, yes, there will be some people that are not going to make it, unfortunately, or will have to wait on a waiting list, but hopefully offering other wraparound services like T-Boss in the interim until we can get them in. We don't have the CAT team yet. That's something that we're hoping to add this year. As far as staffing, we'd have to, you know, take a look at that once we get the funding approved. But we're crossing our fingers that hopefully that will happen.
Right. And Salus Care does have both T-Boss and CAT as well for the community.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, I wanted to switch gears just a little bit and just kind of talk about the Baker Act statute itself. You know, Melissa, it sounds like your family has had a lot of challenges, and for you, you know, the Baker Act has been a very useful tool.
Yeah.
Other people have not necessarily had such a great experience with it. But regardless, you know, the Florida Agency for Healthcare Administration's annual report of Baker Act data from 2014 indicates that you know, the numbers have been going up for at least the past 13 years, if not longer. What do you think accounts for increased use of, I guess, people initiating a Baker Act referral? Could that potentially lead to abuses of the Baker Act statute, or do you think it's maybe more a positive sign? More people know it's out there, and more people are maybe getting the help they need who might otherwise have fallen through the cracks.
I think it's positive. What we have in this community, and there are also in other counties, is a CIT training for police officers. And it's a 40-hour training that they go through. And in that training, they learn signs and symptoms of mental illness. They learn how it might feel to have hallucinations. They can go through a training on that where they actually get the visual and hearing of what voices may sound like. So they can get kind of a firsthand feeling of what some of those obstacles might be for someone that has mental illness. So when they get a call from a family member or the community and they are with this person that's having difficulty or showing signs of trauma, They're able to understand and they're able to assist them more so rather than maybe just taking them to the hospital or taking them to jail. They're able to figure out what the best route of help for this person might be.
Right. And, you know, I know the Citizen Commission on Human Rights of Florida has filed a report kind of critical of how the Baker Act is utilized when it comes to involuntary commitment of minors. And this report included, you know, countless stories from parents here in Florida in the recent past whose kids – a lot of these stories had very similar themes. Their children were Baker Acted from school. The parents weren't notified anything was going on until the referral had already occurred. Some of them were even told, don't even bother coming to the school. Your kid's already in the back of a police car on his way to this facility, and just feeling like they were completely left out of the entire process and that it wasn't necessary. So I was just curious about when it comes to someone like a school resource officer or any law enforcement official sort of initiating that Baker Act referral, what does the statute actually say? Even with this kind of training, are they qualified to make that kind of recommendation? Or again, that does, you know, someone with more mental health certification you know, expertise have to make that call?
And the room goes quiet.
Yes.
I think that is $1 million question, to be honest with you. Being the first responders and going through that CIT training does give them a lot of education as to what to look for. Mental health providers, and like we were talking about earlier, is that a lot of people don't even know what the Baker Act is. Mm-hmm. There has to be a place for it to be initiated. The ultimate goal of it, and I know that the police officers I have spoken to are just said that they're going to go by what the law states, and that's where they feel comfortable with. Mm-hmm. And the ultimate goal is to protect the child or protect anyone that's going under a Baker Act. It is not to hurt anyone. They are not going to jail. It's really to hopefully save them. So I know there's a lot of misnomers about it, and that is it best? I mean, we can weigh that out. But in a crisis situation where you have a child who's threatening to commit suicide, I think that any way that they need to get to us is how it needs to happen.
Police officers that I've spoken with as well, being a first responder, they're coming up onto the crisis of what's happening. And a lot of them will tell me, in good faith, I'm going to protect the family. I'm going to protect the child. And in order for me to do that in good faith, I need to make sure that this child gets to a doctor, a facility that can take a look at what's going on first.
And Tina, just before the show, you were showing me a new Baker Act form. It just came out in July, and this includes kind of new information that wasn't on there before regarding law enforcement if they're involved.
Yes, that's true. At the bottom of the new Baker Act form that has law enforcement officer initiating this examination, it asks two questions. One is, did the officer complete the 40-hour CIT training, and was the examination initiated by an officer who was a resource school officer? So I'm sure these questions are put in here so that they can be tracked for future information.
Gotcha. And we are coming running out of time for this portion of the program. But Melissa, I wanted to end with you. You know, for other parents whose child may be struggling with behavioral or mental health issues, what advice would you give them? You know, where can they start getting the help they need for their child?
I think the best advice that I can say is to never give up. And to never stop asking questions, and to always seek out the best things, the best therapies that you can find for your child. They are out there. Some days it feels like you've hit a brick wall, and tomorrow you might hit the same brick wall. But you have to really remember that there is a lot of stuff out there, but you really have to seek it out. And I would just say be patient with your children and work through the therapies that, you know, because our children are worth it. And I think that's really it. And educating schools, working with the schools, working with law enforcement, working with your counselors. There's always people there to help you. And we've had a really good experience with everybody we've come in contact with. So I think if you ask the right questions and you ask for the help and you're willing to help your child, you're going to have success.
All right. Well, we'll leave it there. That is all the time we have for this portion of the program. Thanks so much to my guests, Tina Sumo, Assistant Vice President with Acute Care Services at Solace Care in Fort Myers, Jennifer Ernst, the Chief Operating Officer at Charlotte Behavioral Healthcare, and Melissa Caldwell, who shared her son Caleb's story about treating mental illness. So great to speak with you all.
Thank you.
We're taking a short break, but when we return, with sustainable food production as a key step in advancing manned space travel, NASA has already begun growing vegetables at the International Space Station through a program with roots right here in Southwest Florida. We explore the Sarasota-based company and the Sarasota farming operation who are helping to make space farming possible. That conversation's just ahead. Stay with us. You're listening to WGCU NPR for Southwest Florida.